We will not have access to heaven if we don't address sin on earth. That's plainly taught in scriptures. I firmly believe it. There is no such thing as a perfect congregation. There is no such thing as a perfect individual. The Bible uses the word perfect in the sense of complete, but not without fault. But having said that, I believe it is possible and expected that we be Christians, we be congregations, that the Lord blesses because we as individuals and congregations are genuinely faithful to Him. And anything less is unacceptable. What if the Lord sent a letter to your congregation this week, and now next Sunday it's read before the whole congregation? Maybe even more trepidatious, what if He sent a letter about you and I to be read to the congregation? What would it include? What would He say? These are distressing and somewhat frightful days for in which we live, morally and spiritually. Therefore, I think it's very prudent for us to take a hard look at ourselves and our congregations. And that's what I hope to do a little bit this afternoon. We are an alien group in a hostile land. Or are we? Or are we? If we're God's children, we are to be. That was true in the first century. It's true in this century. I believe the closer Paul grew to the conclusion of his ministry, and he probably wrote the passage that my lesson is taken from in Romans 12, maybe about 75-80% of the way through his ministry. The closer one gets to the end as a Christian, I believe the greater their intensity becomes. As we get to Romans 12, and my passage is taken from the second verse of Romans 12, it is clear that Paul is not exhorting those brethren and through the Holy Scriptures us. He's not exhorting them to try a little harder. He's not exhorting them to do a little better. No, I believe he's pressing them for an absolute radical transformation of their inner convictions and their external behavior. I believe that's what "be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed" means. Exhorting them, exhorting us to go to beyond cultural religiosity and superficial religion. Now, Paul had spent previous chapters in that book in theology and some rather harsh words to both Jews and Gentiles in chapters 1 and 2. But as he so often does in his writings, as he gets toward the end of the letter, he gets practical. He did this in many of his epistles. He does it here in Romans. And in Paul's practicality, he calls for a commitment to Christ-like living. Paul no longer was primarily interested in theologically instructing them, as he had done in previous chapters. Now he wants an application. And he wants to drive this home. It's a little bit like David on his deathbed, driving certain points home to Solomon, his son. It wasn't that the Romans, and maybe it's true for us, didn't necessarily need more truth, but they need application of the truth that they had heard. So you might say here in chapter 12 of Romans, Paul kind of quits preaching and maybe to some starts meddling. He gets down into the deepest recesses of our lives. Paul isn't asking them and us to make a few minor adjustments in our lives. Rather, he's calling for a radical change deep in the core of where we live. And Paul leaves us with his key concern, or one of his key concerns for us, when he says, "Be not conformed to this world." John in Revelation chapter 1 verse 9, referring to the church, refers to them as a companion in tribulation. Great stress upon the church. The first century they were surrounded by paganism. And as you read the seven letters in Revelation, many of them were being conformed to this world. And it is easy to become discouraged about the state of the world, the state of our country, the hostility toward Christianity and the Bible, maybe even depressing. And then you add to that the impact that the world is having on many religious organizations, where sin is being tolerated, rationalized in ways Scripture simply doesn't permit, where love is losing its essential toughness, where feelings supersede salvation, discipline being ignored. Maybe our letter, if the Lord were to write one to us today, would most certainly contain the words, "John, don't be conformed to this world. Insert your name." Where true godliness is increasingly rare in case after case, where even in our pulpits, sermons inch closer and closer to worldly doctrines. Once saved, always saved. Our preaching gets softer and softer, where Paul's got more adamant. Sober worship is getting harder to find. The faithful look at this and wonder, how many candlesticks will Christ ultimately have to remove before he comes? All because the warning, "Be not conformed to this world," was not heeded. When we look at the church, which is looking at us, we want to see noble things. For the church to truly be in Christ, and Christ in it, as Paul talks to us about in Ephesians and Colossians. We desire fruit-bearing branches, that our walk in the Spirit is faithful. But too often, there's less Christ, more barren branches, more paths of the flesh. As we knowingly or unknowingly become more conformed to this world. It was Soren Kierkegaard who said, "There are a lot of parade ground Christians who wear the uniforms of Christianity but are not willing to do the battle for Christ and His kingdom. They are conformed rather than transformed." Another man called them camouflaged Christians. This passage in Romans chapter 12, verse 2, and you're quite familiar with the wordage, does raise many questions. I won't have time or choose to deal with all of them, but it does present a real challenge. Challenges and questions that need to be thoughtfully assessed and given biblical answers. For instance, how does the command, "Be ye not conformed to this world," fit with Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 9:22, where he says, "I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some"? How is becoming all things to all people not conforming to the world? Or in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 32, he says, "I try to please everyone in everything I do." How does not conforming match with not offending the world? You can't always please people. Can't even always please yourself. But you certainly can't can't please people of the world if you don't conform and accept their thoughts and their ways. But the reasons those questions arise is not because Paul was confused. Paul was dealing with two Christian, maybe human impulses, principles, in a balance. When Christ unleashed the gospel on the world, he unleashed two powerful impulses or forces that spread everywhere the gospel went. The two impulses that are in tension with one another, at times seeming to push in opposite directions. Andrew Wells, in his book, The Missionary Movement of Christian History, calls these two impulses the indigenous principle and the pilgrim principle. The indigenous principle is the concept that Christians, the gospel, is to fit into the lives and all the multiplicity of cultures. At the same time, and just as powerfully, the gospel produces a pilgrim mindset. It rebukes, it corrects cultures. It rebukes, it corrects you and I. It turns people into pilgrims and aliens in their own culture. When Paul says, "Do not be conformed to this world," he is not confused. He is calling for a cultural balance with, "I will be all things to all people, and yet I will not be conformed to this world." Jesus describes this concept. He didn't use those words, but I believe he describes this concept in John chapter 17, verses 15 through 16, where he says, "I do not ask that you take them," speaking to his Father, "out of this world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world. They are in the world." That's the indigenous principle. "They are not of the world." That's the pilgrim principle. Or Christians are to be separate from the world and yet participate in the world, as Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 6:17. "Therefore, go out from their midst and be separate from them." But then in 1 Corinthians 5:9, he tells them, "Don't go out of the world." And maybe even sometimes have closer contact with those that aren't of the faith than those who have been of the faith and left the faith. Therefore, Romans chapter 12, verse 2, becomes critical, because he's exhorting us to be clean in a dirty world. And dirt is always more contagious than cleanliness. If you go out and get your hands, clean hands, in mud, the mud doesn't become clean, the hands become muddy. Artist Andy Warhol, and I'm not an advocate or a fan of him, don't really understand him. But one of his paintings was kind of interesting. It was a picture of, he took a picture of Da Vinci's Last Supper. Most of you have seen that. And then he superimposed over that a logo of General Electric and a wrapper from a bar of Dove soap. Some people thought he was trying to be irreverent, and I think he had the capacity for that. But in this particular painting, I'm not sure he was. I think what he was trying to say is that spiritual values depicted in his painting by the Last Supper are often overshadowed or hidden by worldly items. In Job chapter 34, verse 4, it says, "Let us choose to us judgment. Let us know among ourselves what is good." In other words, you should choose to follow what is right, but you first must decide and accept what is good. When the waters get muddied and our discernment gets blurred, we can't see clearly to discern good and bad. Likewise, when we muddy the waters of our lives with culture and philosophy of this world, we lose our ability to discern right and wrong. When the eye becomes dominant and the spiritual eye sees the entire world through a distortion. Some of you might remember the story of Gulliver Travels, where the man was washed up on the beach. All these little people, and I'm not talking about little, but I mean, I'm talking little people. What are we going to do? Because he could easily devastate their homes, their lives. So they put a thread over Jonathan, or Gulliver. That didn't have any effect, but he was asleep. They put another thread. By the time he woke up, to make a long story a little shorter, they had put enough threads over him so that he couldn't get up. A single thread by single thread by single thread. I believe that's often the way conforming to this world occurs amongst God's family. Maybe amongst God's congregations. Always think about the impact it's going to have down the road. The early church, it appears to me, had its greatest impact upon the world when it lived least like the world. There was an article that appeared, or a headline maybe, just a short article in the Christian Communications newsletter. And the first sentence on this caught my eye. It said, "We are pleased to announce that the cyclone which blew away the church last Friday did no real damage to the town." Now, I know what they meant, but isn't that an interesting thought? The world approaches it as the church disappears, it's not a loss. The town's no worse off for it. Knowledge of what sin is an inverse ratio to its presence. I believe the more people understand what sin is and what an abomination it is to God, and how the world is an abomination to God, that's a key to purity. In Matthew chapter 18, beginning with verse 15, there's a passage there that we often talk about in terms of discipline or helping somebody that's stumbled. And it says if somebody's offended or stumbled, go and talk to them. If that doesn't work, take another person with you or two. And if that doesn't work, then you eventually bring it to the church. Beginning with verse 15 there of Matthew 18. I'm not going to turn and read it. I think you're familiar with it. But I was listening to the radio a few weeks ago, and a rather conservative, not Church of Christ, but a rather conservative Protestant preacher was talking about this. And he said he remembered the first time he'd ever read that about confronting sin in the church. So he went to his fellow ministers and said, I have never been in a church that did that. So he went to some of his fellow ministers and asked them, and they said, we've never seen it either. And their advice to him is, don't try it, because if you do, you'll empty out the assembly. It was totally alien, and this was a rather conservative Protestant group. And he found that absolutely amazing, with which I must agree. With which I must agree. Jesus used the term ecclesia twice. The first time he used it was in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, when he says, upon this rock I will build my ecclesia, or church. The second time, and the only other time that I can find that he used that Greek word, was here in Matthew chapter 18, verse 17. Isn't it amazing, as he was just introducing the church, his body, as he wanted it to be, he emphasized the concept of not being conformed to this world, but handling sin in our lives and in our congregations. Is it possible to follow this teaching and not have everyone or most people leave? I think absolutely yes, and I think the Bible teaches us that and shows us that. Let me give you an example of that. I'm going to go to Acts chapter 5. And you may or may not recognize Acts chapter 5, but you're going to recognize the story here. It's Ananias and Sapphira. What a horrific display of public church discipline or within the brotherhood. You know the story, and Ananias and Sapphira lost their lives, just kerplunkto. That would get our attention. Got their attention. I wonder what the community said. Don't go to that church, that's where people die. It wasn't a welcome mat for the community, per se. It wouldn't be the way I'd try to evangelize, come and watch us die. Not exactly putting out the welcome mat. So what was God doing? Well, I think there's a couple of very important verses, at least to me, and I'm going to call your attention to them. Whether you turn to them or not, I don't care. In chapter 5 of Acts, verse 13, and said, "All the rest, doth no man join himself to them, but the people magnified them." Now think about that. The first part of that verse says, nobody rushed to join the way, but the people magnified them. They were impressed by them. It wasn't necessarily that they were going to rush to join church death, but they had a real respect. It says they magnified them. I believe the world, or people of the world, in the honesty of their hearts, do respect people who stand up for what they believe and try to follow the Bible as it is written. But the other verse that strikes me as I look at this is verse 14. "And believers were the more added to the Lord, multitudes, both men and women." Now here you have one of the most stark, maybe one of the harshest examples of discipline against sin. And what happened? The church was respected and the church grew. Now I am not saying let's go home and start throwing people out so we can grow. You know that, not what I'm saying. But if the church conforms to the world, then it's not the church anymore, and why should anybody want to be part of it? If you and I conform to the world, we're not Christians anymore, and why should anybody want to be like us? It's that contrast, I think, that we underestimate its appeal. We underestimate its appeal. The modern approach is to hide our commitment, or hide the commitment to what the Bible teaches as a way to bring people in. Sometimes in our congregations, pardon me, our approach is, let's overlook these things so that we don't lose anybody. If we overlook people because we want things because so we won't lose people, we have probably lost them already, and we may have lost ourselves. Everything needs to be done in love. My topic at Eminence was tough love. Probably the hardest form of love to execute. It's certainly not the most fun. It's certainly not the most fun. The church is a place, it's an assembly of the saved. And it is not designed. Our assemblies, I do not believe God chooses for our assemblies to necessarily be the place to make sinners comfortable. Maybe it's the opposite. Maybe it should make us feel uncomfortable when we're in sin so that we will do something about it. Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 2, his desire was to present the church as a chaste virgin in Christ. Jesus' greatest grief for the churches that we read about in Revelations 2 and 3 was their unholiness and their being conformed to this world. Being conformed to this world. Many people would make good Israelites because we do have that tendency to want to do what others are doing. Augustine, in his classic book, City of God, describes the two cities. I used the terms indigenous and pilgrim. He used the terms city of man and city of God, from which the title of his book comes. And he talks about how we are to be the city of God, not conformed to this world, even though we have to live in this world. He did not mean, nor do I, that the world is destitute of all goodness, all justice. There is goodness. There is some justice in this world. Man has built many great civilizations with virtues derived from being created in the image of God. And Christians should and can be actively involved in this world. Although we're not of the world, we are in the world, and participating in the world is part of being in the world in whatever ways seems appropriate to you. But that is far different than being conformed to this world. If you're still with us tomorrow night, my topic is Christian speech. I do not think there are many areas where our conforming to the world is more obvious than in our speech. But that's tomorrow. A.W. Tozer once wrote, "We are not to be diplomats, but prophets. And our message is not to be compromise, but an ultimatum." Now that sounds harsh. But what he was saying is, the gospel is not a compromise. The gospel is, this is the Lord's way. And if we choose not to live the Lord's way, there are consequences. As individuals and as congregations. It's been said, everybody has a price. I don't know if that's true, but I think in Maine it's probably true. That point at which you or I would sell out our convictions, where we might abandon our moral standard for a personal gain or a preference. But compromise is always subtle, isn't it? People say they believe the Bible, then they stay in churches that don't teach it. They claim conviction about sin and punishment until that sin is committed by a dear loved one of theirs. Maybe a family member. They say they speak out against dishonesty until their boss is dishonest, and to speak out might cost them their job. People have high moral standards until their flesh wins out, and then they compromise. People are honest until just a little dishonesty would save them some money or get them ahead. People know something to be definitely wrong, but for the sake of peace, they brush it under the rug. And so it goes. There's a cadet prayer that I understand all the freshman cadets at West Point say. Whether they believe it or not, I don't know. Being young people, I'm sure some do, some don't. But I thought it was well said, and I read it for you. Make us choose the harder right rather than the easier wrong, and never be contented with half-truth when whole truth can be won. Endow us with courage that is born of loyalty to all that is noble and worthy, that scorns to compromise with vice and justice, and knows no fear when the right and truth are in jeopardy. That's a great prayer. That's a great prayer. It's a great way for us to live. When I think of not being conformed to this world, my mind has to go back to the book of Daniel, where there is just a plethora of examples. But in Daniel chapter 3, there were three young men, maybe still teenagers, but young, and a whole mass of people. The external pressure was to bow down to the idol. The internal principle was to stay true to their God. And again, you know that story, so you know how those three young men attracted. We are all so good at self-justification. When it's truly external pressure, we sometimes redefine it as internal conviction. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were driven by internal principles, not external pressures. They were transformed, not conformed. And oh, the rationalizations that they could have used in their own minds. Well, if we die, we're not going to be any service to God. At least let's get through this so that we can serve the Lord in our later years. And on and on. But they took the concept of not being conformed to this world with the ultimate courage. You and I are probably not going to be threatened with the fiery furnace, lion's dens, beheadings. But we are, or can be, threatened by hell. I don't mean this to be harsh, but I do mean it to be frank. I'm not Paul, but I'm in the last 25 or 15 or 2% of my work here on earth. And I find myself maybe more intense, not better, more intense. More intense. And when I see within our congregations, when I see within my brothers and sisters, when I sometimes see within myself a conforming behavior rather than a transforming behavior, it is deadly serious. If we do not address sin on this earth, we will have no access to heaven. Period. Paul knew that. Therefore, he said, don't be conformed to this world.